51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. Television that captures aspects of late 20th century culture has been very successful in recent times, be it advertising in Mad Men, serial killers in Mindhunters, or murder in The Assassination of Gianni Versace. Now it's the turn of second wave feminism, and once household names like Gloria Steinem, Betty Friedan and Bella Abzug are centre stage. The series is called Mrs. America, and it stars Cate Blanchett, Rose Byrne, Tracy Ullman and Sarah Paulson. Lise Hand has been watching it for us and she's with me in studio now. We were talking before we came here about how excited we both were watching this series, Lise, but we need to know the backdrop here. I suppose 1970s and the Equal Rights Amendment, we need to know that because that's kind of the hook on which the whole series hangs, isn't it?
Well, it was interesting because it's, I suppose, a slightly forgotten chapter of the civil rights movement in America. You know, it was submerged by so many other things that were going on during that, you know, huge decade of change in Vietnam and so on. So I came to the story, you know, with reasonably fresh eyes. Mm. And it's hooked on the Equal Rights Amendment, which was basically a piece of legislation that was going to enshrine equal rights for men and women in the American Constitution. Mm. It had been first really placed in there in 1923, and it got ratified and re-ratified and so on. And when this TV series opens, it's the early 70s, and the legislation is passing through the houses, and it needs the ratification of 38 of the 50 states. And it was up to 35, and it was proceeding, a piece of legislation that had bipartisan support across Congress, and everything was going smoothly until sachet, we should say, stage left. We have Cate Blanchett playing Phyllis Schlafly. Now, I had to practice that all day, right? Because it's, you know, it's not the name that trips off the tongue, and which is something that is actually, you know, a joke among the feminists in the series. And she's a super smart lawyer, lives in, you know, conservative Illinois, married to a lawyer, defense lawyer. Is your uber conservative, is all about apple pie and mom and so on. But she's one of those women that lives within the constraints of that era of sort of suburbia. But she's incredibly ambitious at the same time. And she's sort of navigating, trying to figure out how she can get ahead, you know, through being an anti-communist and whatever. And there, in the pivotal scene, in the opening episode, she just hits on... This is really what the whole series comes from. She's in this meeting. She's talking about all the ICBM missiles, and she's kind of reeling off all these stats to a room full of guys.
Is that the scene where she's with Goldwater?
Yes.
Yes. Well, I have that scene here. So let us actually listen. Yes. Let us listen to it, because it really gives a sense of, first of all, the brightness of the woman. And this conservative activist, very much at the centre of the first episode, quite definitely, Cate Blanchett, in this big room, Barry Goldwater, played by Peter McNeill, a whole bundle of his advisors are in there as well. And she's having a chat with them about SALT, the Strategic Arms Limitation talks, and what should or shouldn't happen. And here's what happens at that meeting.
Hi, Barry. You know Phyllis.
Phyllis. Nice to see you.
Oh, the pleasure's all mine, Senator.
What do you make of all this ERA business?
It's not her area of expertise.
She's a woman.
Yes, I think I can speak from my own experience. I've never been discriminated against. And I think some women like to blame sexism for their failures instead of admitting they didn't try hard enough. Is it good for you for opposing it?
Well, not so good. I'm the only one.
We know you're short on time, Barry, so I'll cut to the chase. We need your help. You have Nixon's ear. He must be convinced not to sign any arms control treaty with Moscow.
This is Neville Chamberlain all over again.
Look, I know you're not going to want to hear this, but he's determined to sign a treaty.
Well, I think we should focus specifically on our biggest concerns in the treaty, which are the ABM limitations. Now, our superiority in MIRVs does not compensate for the Russian superiority in ICBMs, SS-9s...
Hey, listen, could you take notes for us? You know, so that we have an unofficial record. Well, you probably have the best penmanship of anyone here.
Oh, yes, of course.
Margaret can grab you a pad.
There you go.
My blood pressure rises even listening back to that.
Yeah, your blood pressure rose twice, in fact, listening to that clip.
Yes.
Obviously, the bit at the end, the woman knows exactly what she's talking about, technically brilliant, and then she just, oh, will you take the notes because you're the only woman here. But earlier there was an interesting line as well, the one about women blaming...
Yeah.
blaming. What way does she actually put it? You have it exactly written down in your notes there, the precise quote. Tell me what struck you about the scene, and I'll find that precise quote.
Yeah, I mean, what struck. Well, of course, it was sort of the pivotal scene because she has this moment of sort of truth in the room where she realizes that she's not going to be taken seriously on this. And one of her friends had been back home, had been expressing concern about the ERA and the fact that it might mean that our children our daughters are sent to join the army and our daughters are in foxholes. Mm. And in the space of that meeting, she, to use the word du jour, she pivots away from being an anti-communist and straight into being an opponent of the ERA, because she knew that suddenly this would actually make the men in the room listen to her and kind of, you know, start listening to her and taking her seriously.
The quote I was looking for was, "I think some women like to blame sexism for their failures instead of admitting that they didn't try hard enough."
Well, you see, this is a common theme that comes back the whole way through, particularly when she gets in, starts actually clashing with the great figures of second wave feminism. And this is the thing. I mean, it's an ensemble cast and the acting is only super. Superb. I mean, it really is. I mean, the characters are really rounded. And the great thing is, they're not the sort of usual two-dimensional tropes. You know, there's like victims or bitches or housewives. Like, these are fully rounded women in all their flaws, trying to, as Gloria Steinem, beautifully played by Rose Byrne, says, you know, revolution is messy. And they're trying to kind of feel their way into some kind of, you know, commonality on how to proceed and how to basically unite around Shirley Chisholm, who was the first person of colour, I think, and certainly the first woman that was actually threw her hat in the ring for the presidency. And they were trying to figure out, you know, should they throw abortion rights into this, and, you know, or should they just concentrate on, you know, getting her delegates. And
George McGovern was the Democratic McGovern, yes, candidate eventually in that.
And he was seen as a liberal, and a lot of women supported him. But just the dialogue, I mean, it's quite clear when you watch this that it is actually written by almost all the women writers on this were women, as were most of the directors as well. And it's just little authentic touches. I mean, just moments of brilliance. I mean, even something like when, you know, Phyllis Schlafly went in to see her husband in his office, and she kind of got away on something. And on her way out, she just straightens a picture. And I don't know whether that was snark or just the instinct of a housewife, you know. And I mean, it's tiny little details like that. But there's so many wonderful lines of this open debate between the feminists.
And the other side of it is, we guess it's very brave in one way, because, you know, you might think, yes, they're going to give us the second wave of feminism here. We're going to get the whole argument around the ERA, but we're only going to get it from one side. But the Phyllis Schlafly character is so brilliantly played by Cate Blanchett that there's great balance in it. And we do get, not infighting isn't quite the right word, but we get differences of political opinion on both sides. And it's very interesting how that plays out in amongst those who would be pro ERA. You mentioned Rose Byrne, you know, the big characters, Gloria Steinem, Bella Abzug and Betty Friedan, played by brilliantly, I thought, by Tracy Ullman.
Tracy Ullman is astonishingly good in this. But Cate Blanchett, I mean, you know, this whole project was actually, even the writers didn't think that this is going to see the light of day. Next thing, Cate Blanchett came on board, not only as a star, but as the executive producer as well. And she really drove this project. She really got behind it. And as we've seen her do in so many roles, she just inhabits the character of Phyllis Schlafly, who in real life was actually a most unpleasant person by all accounts. I mean, she was a homophobe, she was a xenophobe, but she was immensely influential. And you can literally draw a line from her right the way through the GOP and the way it sort of split into the Tea Party and ended up with Sarah Palin. I mean, God help us all, if Sarah Palin had, you know, half her brains to match the charisma, I mean, we could be in even more sort of trouble than we are already. But there is, you know, you can actually see how it shaped the lines of American politics to come for decades.
They do play within, I think it's the second, each episode focuses on one woman on one and either side of the debate, or in different parts of the debate, if you like. Episode 2 focuses on Gloria Steinem, played by Rose Byrne, and Betty Friedan, Tracy Ullman playing that role, Bella Abzug played by Margot Martindale. Friedan wants to go forward as the spokesperson. Abzug wants Steinem to go forward as the spokesperson, but Steinem is very politically astute, and this is how she plays that particular aspect.
And I'd like to nominate myself for the Democratic.
You can't nominate yourself, Betty.
Before we get to you acting as spokeswoman, I want to discuss making another push for abortion at the convention. If we gather enough signatures in a petition, we can force a floor vote.
Which would mean being broadcast on national television.
This might not be the right time.
Well, when is the right time?
After we get McGovern into the White House.
So what, a year?
If the ERA is safely in the Constitution.
Or maybe a decade? No, really, I want to know. How long are we supposed to wait? How many more women are going to die from botched abortions while we wait for men to feel comfortable with us having control over our own bodies? How many women are going to be forced to give birth to babies they can't afford to feed while we wait for housewives who have no idea what it's like to have to work to survive to feel comfortable with women having power? How long do we give people to adapt to change? Or am I the only one who's so fucking tired of waiting?
Such a powerful line. I mean, she had so many wonderful lines in it that, she, you know, a lot of the kind of the frustrations of the whole feminist movement sort of were crystallized in Gloria Steinem. I mean, these women were rock stars. Mm. You know, they were known by their first name. It was Betty and it was Gloria. But, you know, I think as well, I mean, the performance that probably blew me away was Uzo Aduba, who we know she played Crazy Eyes in Orange is the New Black, and she plays Shirley Chisholm, and she is absolutely wonderful. She's sort of been rescued from the sort of the forgotten shelf in American history, really, because, you know, people don't really remember what a trailblazer she was and how strong she was, even when the movement around her began to fracture. And she just said, no, we've got to keep going on. I mean, she's a wonderful line. When they're all sort of saying you got to drop out and whatever, maybe you have it.
I think it's within this clip that we're about to hear. Here she is making a stand. The feminist, the movement really is kind of saying, look, we need to have McGovern. That's politically the most astute movement. But Shirley Chisholm isn't going to be pushed to the one side easily.
They say Shirley Chisholm tells it like it is. So I'm going to tell it like it really is. There are women within range of my voice right now that support McGovern. And there are women that support Humphrey and Wallace, and this is your right. But in this country, everybody is supposed to be able to run for president, but that has never really been true. Somebody had to do it first. So I did it. I did it because I was the only one who had the audacity to shake this system up.
Uzo Aduba there as Shirley Chisholm in a scene from Mrs. America, the TV series that Lee's Hand has been speaking to us about. I managed to get two episodes. I wanted to gorge the whole lot in front of me, but I couldn't.
I totally binged. And, you know, when you listen back to that, there's a scene just sort of at the end when she basically concedes at the convention you're looking at, and all her supporters are in the audience, and she's in the centre, sort of holding up hands with all these kind of, you know, oldish white guys, so all the candidates. And all the feminists are cheering, and you can see they're sort of saying, oh God, you know, our day is coming. And you just think back to 2016 and Hillary Clinton, and nothing has changed, you know. And
huge echoes, in fact.
Oh my God. Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, it is absolutely great. It's great. Mm. And it's massively entertaining. It's not worthy.
That's the point about it.
It's great fun. And it's great.
And putting Cate Blanchett as this very distasteful character who you kind of end up liking because she plays her. Well, I ended up liking in certain ways because she plays her so brilliantly.
Oh, she inhabits the role. She's fantastic, as always. Yeah.
Okay, so high recommendation from you, and you can't wait to get to the rest of 9 episodes in total. It brings us right through, I think, until the end of that period in history, the ERA.
Yeah, it sort of hands over to Reagan at the end, which is really interesting,
Okay, that's Lee's Hand speaking to us about Mrs. America. It starts on BBC Two tomorrow night at 9 p.m. I wonder what Phyllis Schlafly would make of that track. It's called Ladies for Babies from Kitchen Sink, new album from Nadine Shah. We reviewed it on Friday night's programme, and both reviewers really highly recommending it, and it is a great album. Kitchen Sink from Nadine Shah. When teenage Tom and his mother Elaine to return to her rural family home in the west of Ireland, they're looking for a fresh start. Tom has a liking for knives, and that, among other things, has precipitated their move. Elaine is none too pleased about it. This is the starting point for The Winter Lake, new film directed by Phil Sheeran and written by David Turpin, and showing at this year's Galway Film Flap. We'll be talking to Phil and David shortly. But first, let's hear a scene from the movie Charlie Murphy as Elaine checking out her welfare status in her new home place.
The problem is the documents here say you've been living in the UK. You have nothing to prove residency.
I know, I've just moved back here. I need to get on the single parents, that's all right, isn't it?
I understand what you're saying, but if you don't have a utility bill or something similar
to
utility bill...
I've no utility bill because I've no utilities. I don't even have a phone yet. But that's got to cover it. I've got those. I've got my ID.
What's the commotion, Pete?
I'm on my own here.
So the girl is moving into the old Matthews Mutton farm. Granddaughter she is.
What has that got to do with anything?
Was that so?
Please.
Oh, we were all very sorry about what happened to your granddad.
Get off me!
Now, there's no call.
Get off, please! Thanks!
Charlie Murphy there in a scene from The Winter Lake. You also heard Aileen Hieron and Michael Roper in that scene. Well, Elaine's troubles are going to move well beyond welfare difficulties very quickly. Her son Tom makes a macabre discovery in the nearby lake and soon finds out that their new neighbours, a father and a daughter, have secrets of their own. Director of The Winter Lake, Phil Sheeran, and the film's writer, David Turpin, join me now. David, as the writer of this, where did this story start for you?
Gosh, I think, you know, a long time ago, I was having a conversation with Ruth Tracy, who's one of the producers of the film, and we spoke about the image of a seasonal lake. I can't remember what the context was, really, but we talked about a lot of things, but that really stayed with me because it made me think about the idea of, I guess, the agency of the landscape, and here we all are, scuttling around on the surface of the earth with all our dramas and our concerns and our problems, but the earth is living its own life, doing its own thing. It's indifferent to us and yet can have this profound effect upon us that we can't control or intervene in.
Yeah, I'm not surprised to hear that something to do with the landscape was certainly there from a very early stage, because, Phil, I think it's safe to say that the shooting of this on location up in and around Sligo and Leitrim, I believe, was the location for the shoot. That landscape and that whole area, it's as much a character in the film as many of the characters themselves, Phil.
Yeah, it is quite likely. And like David pointed out there, like one of his earlier things was he referenced the lake to me as a symbol of repression, like lakes going up and down, you can't keep things buried. So I thought that to extend that into the landscape as a whole and find a more primal thing to represent the baser instincts of the characters and kind of have it on show in the cinematography. So a kind of pathetic fallacy, as it were, goes in there.
The other thing that I wondered how soon it became a topic within what you were writing, David Turpin, for this film was the whole theme of parenthood, because we have a mother and son and a father and daughter pairing. Parenthood seemed to me to be an important theme as well.
Yeah, I mean, I was interested in having these two kind of fractured families that mirror each other in all kinds of ways. But, you know, I mean, something that always kind of grinds my gears with a lot of sort of mainstream cinema, I guess, is there's always a kind of what I think is a gross overemphasis on the idea of, you know, the nuclear family, if you like, as the kind of indissoluble unit of society. And that's wonderful for those of us who have that. But family can also be something that, you know, we have to run from as much as we, you know, might incline toward it. And I thought it was interesting to look at two family units of a sort that don't abide by those normative rules that would be regarded as broken families or somehow aberrant families. Yeah. So that was something that I wanted to look at.
Yeah, well, let's get one of those families in this scene that we're about to listen to. Again, it's Charlie Murphy as the mother, Elaine, talking to her son, Tom, played by Anson Boone. Now, he has just had a glimpse of the neighbour's daughter in the car, Holly, played by Emma Mackey, and his mother then sits him down for what we might call a little chat.
You know the working field?
The dangerous one I told you to stay away from.
Yesterday at Rough Empty.
So you listened to me then? Come here. We're going to have to make a go of this, being here. You don't have a lot of choice. So I need you to help me out and not fight me on everything. When I tell you how things are, that's how they are. Okay? Don't make me feel like I'm talking to myself. I need to hear you say it.
Okay.
Good. Let's see if I can ask the neighbours for a lift into town. Maybe get the car looked at. You're coming with me this time.
That's Charlie Murphy as Elaine and Anson Boone as her son Tom in the film The Winter Lake, which is premiering at this year's Galway Film Fla. And director Phil Sheeran and writer David Turpin are speaking with me this evening. I think anybody in this country will be well aware of Charlie Murphy's acting ability across both television and the theatre. But the accent might throw them into not recognising her there. Although I have a memory of her. Didn't she play in Happy Valley at one stage, Phil? Did you know about that? Because she takes that English accent coming back to Ireland and really holds it for the entire film.
She does, yeah. Happy Valley and Peaky Blinders. Mm. She's made in the accent. But yeah, she was quite adamant with that herself because there was a bit of talk early on in the process of would she still have her Irish accent hangovers? Like, is that bits of the British accent kind of through and through it, or would she commit? And we felt that, like, her personality is someone who feels like she has to be more of a chameleon in whatever environment she's brought into, so she was quite, like, eager to retain this, like, Leeds-based accent. Yes. As a way of helping us understand her character.
Yeah, because we do get that sense of outsider is amplified, yeah, by the continued use of the English accent, and she refers to it specifically herself at one point about, oh sure, I'll be talking like a mucker, I think is the word she uses, before long, now that she's back home. But the real find, or one of the real finds within it for me, was that young actor Anson Boone, who plays the character of Tom. How experienced is he, or how inexperienced is he? He's very talented.
He's about to be huge, I would say. He kind of came onto the scene and was in, like, he was in Quentin Tarantino's favourite film of last year, a monster movie called Crawl, believe it or not. But he was in that, and then he's one of the soldiers, one of the, like, small part soldiers in 1917, and then he's in our film. But it was just like, even in the audition, it was like 2 minutes into the audition and it was kind of like, God, we can pack up now. This is brilliant. He's absolutely amazing. He was just that there was so much commitment and he had all these like very, like a proper, a real feel for the character and like real ideas, and he wanted to try things, and it's very peculiar in such a young actor, such an inexperienced actor, to have such a command of it. It was very exciting for him.
Another young performer who's amazing in this is Emma Mackey, playing the character of Holly. David, I think you were particularly impressed by her performance and how that character came to life on screen.
Yeah, I mean, it's a difficult part because, you know, without wishing to give anything away, a lot of that character is kept kind of back. She has to withhold a lot and yet still compel us and fascinate us. And she's the sort of engine of the story in all kinds of ways that we come to discover as it unfolds. And it's just, I find her performance very interesting in it because, you know, the film is broadly realistic, but it's not a piece of hard realism. In some ways, it's a film noir, you know, and so that you have this young girl in Sligo and Leitrim, and yet occasionally there's just teeny touch of Barbara Stanwyck or Lana Turner or somebody about her, and it's very fascinating to see those two things.
Yeah, she has a very strong,
together.
A very strong screen presence for sure. But as you say, very much grounded in a 21st century realism as well. Here's a scene between herself, Holly, Emma Mackey, sitting with her new neighbour Tom, Anson Boone. They're in the van together. They've just got that lift to town that we heard about in the previous scene.
Your mum works fast, isn't she? And she's young. What was she when she had you, like 12?
Don't talk about her like that.
All right, whatever. It's not exactly a catch. You
He used to work at your place, you know. Just after we moved here. Doing fences.
They all fell down.
Didn't say he was any good at it. We didn't think the old guy on the farm had anyone. What was he, your granddad?
Great granddad.
She really is young. You know, he was laying there for weeks before anybody knew he was dead. Nobody thought to check until the animals started starving in the fields. Guess they weren't close. You don't talk much, do you? That's okay. I like it.
Yeah, of course he doesn't talk much. And that's part of his great screen presence. Anson Boone there in the character of Tom, and the voice that you heard for the most part of that clip, Emma Mackey as Holly. In fact, my producer just saying to me she's French and British, so she's managed to switch accent as well in a very, very convincing way in that scene. But we get hints there, David, of the kind of dynamic that might start to build between the two parents. I'm just wondering in the writing of this, because it is very much there are hidden secrets that are going to unsurface as the film progresses. How much did you know when you were setting out to patch out the screenplay? Did you plot that all beforehand, or did you let some of the things just unfold in front of your eyes?
What are you trying to make me say? I can't reveal anything.
No, I don't want you to reveal anything about it, but I'm just wondering how much you had already decided in your head at the point of writing.
It was pretty clear in my mind where it was going. Usually I usually get a very firm sense of the beginning and then a very firm sense of the ending, and then it can be quite a circuitous journey to kind of find the most direct route between those two places. But yeah, it was always quite clear to me where it was heading.
How would you define, Phil, the type of masculinity that we get in the character of Ward, played by Michael McElhattan?
Like, it's pretty much as toxic as it gets, I suppose. But the thing I really liked about what Michael did for it was that I wouldn't even say he brought a humanity to it, but there was you could see the complexity of his own thought process as a character, that, like, the justifications for what he does and how he's able to rationalize it in his head. So I found that brilliant. But I also found that brilliant with Michael in terms of just how he would, like, was pretty relentless in making that feel real rather than anything else, rather than caricatures or whatever.
Yeah, you've made a few short films, Phil, but this is your first full-length feature, and now we have this kind of virtual version of the Galway Film FLA. I presume it's still very exciting for it to be getting its premiere at this year's FLA.
It is. I love the FLA. Like, one of my shorts won a few years ago at it, so I have a kind of special connection to it, actually. Like, it's still, like, I wish it was going as so do we all, like, that the COVID wasn't around, but yeah, I would have loved to be in there with an actual audience and then just go for a beer afterwards.
So how will you watch it? Will you watch it together separately, if you know what I mean? Will you be doing that on Zoom in your own houses, or how are you going to manage that one, David?
I guess I'll be watching it like I watch most things, alone in a darkened room. Yeah.
So there'll be no conversation with Phil until after the event. Well, listen, we'll finish up with the scene between Charlie Murphy again, and this time Michael McElhattan as Ward. In fact, I should say that Maeve, or Emma, by the way, Emma Mackey plays Maeve in Sex Education. People may recognise her from that. She's playing the character of Holly. But this final clip then, both Holly and Tom are out and about together. They're not answering their phones, and the two parents back at home are getting a little bit worried and a little bit close.
If they're not back by dark, I'll take the van out.
There's not a lot of men like you out there, you know.
Oh. You know all the men in the world, do you?
No. Just feels that way. Us one didn't end so well, actually. It's kind of why we're here. There was a fight. Well, I mean, there were lots of fights, but this one got physical. Just a bit. I mean, a slap. Tom went for him. He got that knife thing he carries around and slashed him.
Slashed him?
Oh, it's just a scratch.
Yeah, but you said he slashed him.
No, you're getting the wrong end of the stick. It was just a scratch.
Well, which was it?
He gets things wrong sometimes.
Oh, yes, there's a story there. Michael McElhattan, as Ward, Charlie Murphy as Elaine, and that in a scene from The Winter Lake, directed by Phil Sheeran, written by David Turpin, who were speaking with us just before that. You can see the film. It screens at the Galway Film Flat online this Friday, 9 p.m. And you can find out full details about that and everything happening at the Flat in this virtual version that we're getting in 2020. GalwayFilmFlat.com. You're listening to Tuesday Night's Arena. Strike the pose.
Strike the pose.
Oh, why am I playing Madonna and Vogue? Well, it's time for this week's Where Do I Begin? Our series where we look at well-known artists, musicians and writers and take a look at roots into their work. Tonight is the turn, not of Madonna, but of the filmmaker David Fincher. Self-taught American director began his career working on special effects for Return of the Jedi and Indiana Jones. But in the mid-80s, Fincher took on the world of music videos, directing over 50 of them, including Madonna's Vogue, hence our playing it this evening, and George Michael's Freedom, one of the other big hits that he had. At the same time, he co-founded a TV commercial company called Propaganda Films, which went on to become one of the most influential agencies in the world. In the early 90s, he ventured into feature film, making his debut with, oh dear, the much maligned Alien 3. But despite Fincher despising his experience with Alien 3, he subsequently created films that in essence capture the very definition of the era they were released in. Films like Fight Club, Zodiac and The Social Network. John Maguire has been looking at the extraordinary career of director David Fincher, and you were saying to me just as we started that he's a guy who knows to be in the right place at the right time. That starts when we ask where do I start with David Fincher. Well, being growing up next door to George Lucas
is a
pretty good start, isn't it?
The family moved to Marin County in just outside San Francisco, and their next door neighbour was Fincher's next door neighbour was George Lucas, who was at the height of his powers at the time. Fincher, like you say, was self-taught. He never went to film school. He started working in photography and special effects studios when he was still in high school, and graduated high school and went straight to work for probably the greatest company name of all time, Industrial Light and Magic, which was owned by Lucas then. And he worked, like you say, on special effects for Return of the Jedi and Indiana Jones and those kind of films. And just at the birth of MTV, Fincher started making music videos. And from there, started working with Propaganda Films, co-founded Propaganda Films, which was just hugely influential. They at one point made a third of all TV ads in the United States, and they had a roster of directors who would go on to Hollywood fame, like Michael Bay, Zack Snyder, Michel Gondry, all these Spike Jones. They were working for Propaganda and making these films. When Fincher got the chance to make a feature, he was handed a poison chalice. Alien 3 was already a disaster by the time he came on board, and it didn't work, and he's disowned the film publicly and loudly ever since. But he had his foot in the door, and it was very quickly afterwards that he made Seven, which was a revelation when it came out in 1997.
What do you think that training, if you like, or that working across music videos in particular, and Madonna's Vogue, hence, as I said, hence our playing a bit of the track tonight, what did he learn there? Did he carry that aesthetic with him when it came to making features?
Kubrick used to always say that music videos and TV ads were the ultimate films, in that you had to tell a story in 30 seconds and in a music video in 3 minutes. And that's what Fincher learned. And it's fascinating. His background is fascinating because all of the things that we're familiar with, his touchstone touches, if you like, visual stylization, pinpoint editing, a visual talent that was formed in that short burst of ads and pop videos. He learned how to frame. He learned how to use the camera. He learned precision. He learned wide shots that are full of detail that have an economy to them and a purpose to them. And one of Fincher's great innovations, and he's got a career full of innovation, particularly technical innovations, is in matching the camera move to the character movement in the frame, so that as the character moves, the camera moves. So the movement becomes the message, and it introduces an enormous pace to the storytelling. And that's what he managed to do in stretching 3 minutes to 2 hours. And that's a great trick that not all of them learned.
Yeah, and so you, as you mentioned, Alien 3, yes, that was the debut feature and a bit of a disaster. 7, however, made €350 million, I think it was, at the box office.
And it was an original serial killer story told with this kind of wet film noir. It rains constantly and it's set in Seattle. And it has the story of a veteran detective and a rookie chasing down a compulsive murderer whose grim work is inspired by the 7 biblical deadly sins. But what it did was and Fincher does this throughout his career, it turned Brad Pitt into an actor, which he had not been prior to that, really. He was a pretty boy. He turned him into an actor. And it told a story that was compulsive to watch. It's chaptered into the 7 chapters of the deadly sins. It had this great protagonist played by Kevin Spacey, antagonist played by Kevin Spacey. And it was a compulsive watch. And like you say, a massive hit, massive hit.
But you're actually starting us with Fight Club. Do you think is that the landing point for, or maybe the taking off point Fincher?
I think there's a good argument to be made that Fincher has produced and directed the three defining films of the last 3 decades. Not necessarily the best films, but the films that caught the cultural moment. I was going to use the word zeitgeist, but I don't like the word zeitgeist.
And
but
now you've used it twice.
That cultural moment, that tension, that anxiety that's out there in the last 30 years, he's managed to capture it 3 times. Fight Club being the first of them, Zodiac the second, which is his masterpiece, and The Social Network, the story of Facebook, which is extraordinary. Fight Club ties the problem of toxic masculinity and male violence to late-stage capitalism. That's what Chuck Palahniuk's original novel is about. Zodiac asks the question if the truth can ever really be found or known, which is a very contemporary question. And The Social Network opens with a scene in a room full of people socialising and closes on a man alone in a different room, endlessly pressing refresh on his computer keyboard. It couldn't be more apposite to the times that we live in.
Right.
So those 3 films, he's managed to do that over 3 decades. He's managed to just get it right each time.
Let's listen to a clip from Fight Club. Brad Pitt, again, as you said, this is the second time then that Fincher worked with him immediately after 7. And Pitt is playing the charismatic and dangerous Tyler Durden, and he's greeting new members of Fight Club.
Gentlemen, welcome to Fight Club. First rule of Fight Club is, you do not talk about Fight Club. The second rule of Fight Club is, you do not talk about Fight Club. Third rule of Fight Club, someone yells stop, goes limp, taps out, the fight is over. Fourth rule, only 2 guys to a fight. Fifth rule, 1 fight at a time, fellas. Sixth rule, no shirts, no shoes. Seventh rule, fights will go on as long as they have to. And the 8th and final rule, if this is your first night at Fight Club, you have to fight.
Brad Pitt there in a scene from Fight Club, which is the film that John McGuire is getting us to start with when it comes to getting to understand David Fincher. And you mentioned that in the innovations that he had in terms of, you know, the movement of the camera and I suppose the choreography of scenes.
That's right.
Played directly into this film,
so
John.
So precisely played out. His use of, like you say, fight choreography and camera movement, but also his seamless and almost invisible use of visual effects, which would become the signature throughout his career. Sometimes it's quite showy and blatant, but most of the time Fincher uses effects work invisibly. It's there to create detail and to build a world. It's not there to show off. But Fight Club is a film with as many champions as it has detractors. It's not a film that I think has aged particularly well. At the time in 1999, yes, it had something to say. But 20 years ago, the idea that men were experiencing this crisis of masculine disenfranchisement and anomie, yes, it was worth exploring. But the urgency of that crisis seems to have faded, if it ever really existed, and it's been superseded by other identity crises. But at the time, he had his thumb right on it at the time. Fight Club was a massive film.
So is that the social commentary that you would say he was making at the time, or was there something else going on?
I think he was attracted to the idea of two guys beating the lining out of each other in a basement. I think that was the first notion. But from that, his extension of that and into areas of politics, social politics and the corporate world, I think that's really interesting in what he was trying to say. But some of those issues have faded somewhat, and right. It's not maybe as relevant as it was back then.
And the twist is quite important.
Yeah, the twist is very important to Fincher in almost all of his films.
Yeah, because anybody who has seen Seven will remember the moment. And
there's another twist. Yeah, we're not going to spoil any of these films.
Well, if you haven't seen it, go watch it.
But there is always a playfulness with narrative that he has. Even in the films that he's made that aren't particularly good, like Panic Room, The Game with Michael Douglas was built around a twist. And the only dud, really, in his entire filmography, which is The Curious Case of Benjamin Button, which again brought him back with Brad Pitt, aging backwards from an old man to a baby from an F. Scott Fitzgerald story. But it was a sharp turn into kind of mass market romanticism that, thankfully, Fincher has not repeated. It did not work.
Zodiac, you refer to as his masterpiece. Newspaper cartoonist Robert Graysmith, played by Jake Gyllenhaal, becomes obsessed with the Zodiac. And is involved with Robert Downey Jr.'s journalist. This is the why is it his masterpiece, would you say?
Well, first of all, there's a 5-year gap between Panic Room, which he made in 2002, and Zodiac, which came out in 2007. And he spent those 5 years researching the Zodiac case, who was the serial killer who operated in the 60s and 70s in his hometown of San Francisco. Fincher has a very close personal connection to this in that he was terrified, or so he says, as a child, of the concept of the Zodiac. And to me, it's his masterpiece because it's so beautifully handled and managed. And it's the philosophical notion that the truth is sitting there right in front of you, but you cannot touch it. You can't get close to it. Mm. And every time you do put your hand out to grab it, it recedes further away into the distance. And that's really gripping when you're watching a film, when you're watching the story, and every instinct in your body wants conclusions, catharsis. You want things to be answered. You want questions answered. And he can't do that. And he handles that so brilliantly.
And Gyllenhaal plays the cartoonist, as I said, Robert Graysmith, and obsessed, in your words, with tracking down the Zodiac killer. And his colleague, Paul Avery, is played by Robert Downey Jr. And here, I think there's a couple of pints on board, or a couple of drinks on board for this scene, at any rate. They're trying to crack the Zodiac's code.
But who actually cracked the code? A married couple who like puzzles, so what's that tell us about the Zodiac?
He's no expert.
Right, it's just a simple substitution code like the one that we used to do as Boy Scouts. A is 1, B is 2.
We were no Boy Scouts, Robert.
Well, it's not that hard. You just gotta know where to start, though. In the first cipher...
You actually carry that around with you?
Why?
No reason.
What's the most common double consonant in the English language?
Consonant?
The double L.
Double L.
And what's the one word that we know that he'll use in here at least once?
Kill.
Right, kill. So the Hardens start looking for double symbols, which they find here, here, and here, each with the same two symbols preceding them. So now they've got a repeating four-letter word ending with two symbols that they assume stand for L.
And since I think the whole word is kill.
And you got your K, you got your I, and you're on your way.
But how do you go from A as 1 and B as 2 to figuring out this whole cut?
Well, same way I did. You go to the library.
Suddenly you're back there in algebra at school and it becomes a little bit frightening, doesn't it? That's from Zodiac, Jake Gyllenhaal and Robert Downey Jr. 2007 film from David Fincher, and the second film that John Maguire is suggesting we might watch if we're trying to decode
Fincher.
He spent mountains of time shooting and reshooting. He was obsessive in terms of that. You know, is that just obsession or does it pay off? You would say in Zodiac, yes, I'm guessing.
Yes, I think it does. I think Fincher's his perfectionism comes out in the films that he makes. He has this reputation of somebody who has extraordinarily long shoots. He gets 150 days or 170 days when most films would be shot in half that time. He gets a full year for post-production. Again, an extravagance and an indulgence. And as actors will say, he goes 200 takes sometimes, which is incredibly difficult on actors and a very hard thing to do. And to manage a set like that shows the kind of obsessive attention to detail that the director has himself. It's you know, it's almost natural that it would come out in the work. But if we pass over The Curious Case of Benjamin Button and we come to The Social Network, this was a script by Aaron Sorkin, the West Wing writer, that had been passed around Hollywood for maybe 2 years at this stage.
Yeah, Fincher, a lot of talking.
A lot of talking, yeah. But Fincher glommed onto it straight away because it goes back to this notion that he just has his thumb on exactly where the culture is. And The Social Network is a biopic of a website, really. It's a biopic of Mark Zuckerberg. It's not the most appealing concept, but the way that he draws all the issues that we're currently struggling with, even today, issues around privacy, issues about your personal information, issues about our contact online, those kind of questions are all explored through the character of Mark Zuckerberg, who is not a reliable person, doesn't seem to be a particularly nice person. He's this robotic, almost sociopathic individual.
As portrayed by
Eisenberg. Jesse Eisenberg, who's superb in it. But the questions that the film has, again, there's not an awful lot of answers, but there is an extraordinary last section in the film and that last moment that I mentioned earlier where he's sitting alone in a room with a computer. Just the expression of philosophical despair in the times that we live in. Yeah. Fincher is known for that. It's dark. It's darkness.
A little bit ahead of the existential moment, there's a straightforward argument about who owns the company
and who owns the multi-billion dollar company.
Andrew Garfield playing Eduardo Saverin here, confronting Jesse Eisenberg's Mark Zuckerberg. He's forced him out of the company at this stage. Justin Timberlake as Sean Parker is also in this scene. A bit of strong language within this too.
You signed the papers. You set me up. You're going to blame me because you were the business head of the company and you made a bad business deal with your own company.
This is going to be like I'm not a part of Facebook.
It won't be like you're not a part of Facebook. You're not a part of Facebook.
My name's on the masthead.
You might want to check again.
It's because I froze the account?
You think we were going to let you parade around in your ridiculous suits pretending you were running this company?
Sorry! My Prada's at the cleaners! Along with my hoodie and my fuck you flip-flops, you pretentious douchebag!
Security's here. You'll be leaving now?
I'm not signing those papers.
We will get the signature.
Tell me this isn't about me getting into the Phoenix. I knew you did it. You planted that story about the chicken.
I didn't plant the story about the chicken. What's he talking about?
You had me accused of animal cruelty.
Seriously, what the hell's the chicken?
And I'll bet what you hated the most is that they identified me as a co-founder of Facebook, which I am. You better lawyer up, asshole, because I'm not coming back for 30%. I'm coming back for everything.
Oh, to be continued, you're saying to me, Joe McGuire, that there could be a follow-up to The Social
Network.
There
is talk about a sequel to it, and I think it'd be worthwhile, absolutely. Yeah.
Andrew Garfield, Jesse Eisenberg, and Justin Timberlake in that scene from The Social Network, which is the third movie that you suggested we go to. But you wanted to say, just before we finish up, about, to go back to your theme from the beginning, being in the right place at the right time, being ahead of the posse, in fact.
Ahead of the game, and able to see which way the wind is blown, because Fincher moved to Netflix with projects like The House of Cards, an extraordinary remake of the BBC and hugely popular, and Mindhunter, which was about the origins of the FBI's psychological evaluation department. And those two projects were massive on Netflix. And now for his new film, which is budgeted at something like $200 million, and it's a black and white biopic of somebody, you know, that even film buffs would have trouble putting a name to this guy, Herman J. Mankiewicz, who was the guy who wrote loads of films, but in particular he wrote Citizen Kane with Orson Welles, and it's about the battle for credit for the script for Citizen Kane, and it's a fascinating concept, a brilliant idea, written by his late father Jack Fincher, with a great cast, and that's on Netflix apparently in October.
Alright, well, we will watch out for that in the meantime. Fight Club, Zodiac and The Social Network are the three films that John McGuire chooses to help us get to know David Fincher, and that brings us to the end of this evening's programme.